The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton, for the stay.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh, how so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit, or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
The NBA playoffs are here, and with FanDuel, your group chat's about to be going off. Because right now, new customers can bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets if you win. And with live bets, your heart emojis will really be racing from tip-off to the final buzzer. Plus, when you win, you'll get paid faster than your friends can send you a victory gif. Or is it GIF? Who cares? You won! So get the word out to your crew and download FanDuel today. New customers bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets if you win. Make every moment more with FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. Official partner of the NBA.
21 plus and present in Ohio. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued is non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Hello, Kaori Okano, and welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies. It's a pleasure to have you here and to talk about the book you co-edited with Yoshio Sugimoto, Rethinking Japanese Studies, Eurocentrism, and the Asia-Pacific Region. I have to confess that when I first saw the title of the book, even before I was able to actually hold it in my hands, I thought, yes, Rethinking Japanese Studies from a perspective of Eurocentrism is definitely something that should be on our agenda, something that all of us who are engaged in the field should think about very seriously. So I'm actually excited that we can talk about the book. But before we get into the discussion, could you tell us a little bit about yourself? For example, how you became involved in Japanese studies and how did the idea for this book come about?
Thank you for a very generous introduction, Raman. It's a pleasure to be here and it's a pleasure to be able to speak about this book, which I edited with Yoshio last year, and it came out last year. I was born and grew up in Hiroshima, Japan, until I finished my undergraduate study. I studied what they call curriculum study of English. Basically, I was hoping to teach English at senior high school. However, I had opportunity to spend a year in New Zealand, in Auckland University, in early 80s as an exchange student sponsored by Ministry of Education for a year. And it really changed my perspective of my future and where I want to be. I really had a great time there, living in a dormitory with Pacific Islanders from Tonga, Tokelau, Cook Island, Samoa, etc., etc. And I was taking an anthropology class of modernization theory, whereby modernization as defined by the Western concept is not actually possible for these Pacific Island nation states. So that's where my interest in the social science emerged. I went back to Japan after that and I was going to be a teacher, but then I realized that maybe I should go outside of Japan for a while before I settle down on the proper permanent full-time job, since it seemed to me at the time, maybe this is not the case in 2018. But at the time, I felt that once you settle in one particular job, it would be quite hard to get out. Hence, I tried to look for a job as a Japanese Peace Corps in a Pacific island. But having an arts degree, I was pretty useless. What they're looking for is a panel beater or a bricklayer or a PE teacher and others. So I decided maybe doing a postgraduate study in that part of the world is the easiest option. And indeed, that was the case. So I did a postgrad study, master's degree in Sydney University. And then I taught at high school in Sydney. Then I moved to New Zealand to teach another 2 years before I decided to return to university to do PhD. By that time, I had been a school teacher for 3 years in the Anglophone environment. And comparing my own experience of schooling in Japan and what I observed in Australia, in New Zealand, at the ground, on the ground level of schooling, I decided to do ethnographic study of schooling amongst the working class kids in Japan. And that's where I started my research career. And after finishing my PhD, I got the job at the La Trobe University where I am. And I've been here for a long time. I wouldn't say how many years, but I've been here a very, very long time. I teach Asian studies, introduction to Japan, as well as some advanced language studies, also supervising postgrad students in Asian studies. Not only on Japan, but also on other parts of Asia, such as Indonesia and others. I have two children, now 22 and 19, and experiencing schooling of Australia as a parent of a minority children was also given me another perspective of how the children of diverse background experience and get out different things from what's called mainstream schooling. So I value the experience of schooling and education, being parent, greatly as something that informs my research agenda as well.
So I was just going to say that, yes, I'm assuming that the experience as a parent informs your career as a researcher as well, right?
That's right. And the kind of topic that I have chosen, which is mainly the sociology and anthropology of education. My research area, I mean, this book is about Japanese studies, and this is the first time that I actually went beyond more empirical studies. I then wrote essays about what I do as a researcher. My research area actually is sociology and anthropology of education and young people. So I work and publish on, in particular, education and social inequality in Japan and in Asia. And when I say inequality as an intersection of gender, social class.
Mm-hmm, I see.
So I work on minority education, migrant education, etc., etc. Yeah.
Okay. So then what is the story of the book? Where did you get the idea for such a book? It's Rethinking Japanese Study.
Well, the book really isn't a product of a philosophical debate drawing on a post-colonialism, Eurocentrism as a social theory. It came out of more pragmatic concerns when I was the conference convener. The Japanese Studies Association of Australia, as we call JSAA, convene a conference every 2 years. And then I was asked to convene a conference in 2013 in order to hold the conference at La Trobe University in 2015. So I had 2 years to prepare for this. And I had a committee of four people, consisting of myself, Yoshio Sugimoto, Lydia Tanaka, who is a linguist, and Elise Foxworth, who is a literary scholar. And when we were talking about, first of all, we had to decide on the date and then decide on the keynote speakers. And when we were discussing who to invite as a keynote speaker, and then at that point, we were convinced that we'd get a certain amount of funding from Japan Foundation and elsewhere. And we knew that we could get three or four international speakers. And then we looked at the list of keynote speakers of JSSA conference in the last 10, 15 or more years, and then realized that all these keynote speakers actually come from North America or Europe or Japan, nowhere else. So we decided, this is a bit strange. The Japanese studies is not exclusive property of Anglophone world or Western world, and we know that the mainland China, PRC, South Korea, also has quite a large number of scholars who work on Japanese studies, let alone the number of people who actually learn Japanese language. So we decided, for a change, let's get keynote speakers from Asia, not from North America or continental Europe. And hence we decided, in that case, there is a big debate about Eurocentrism in social sciences and political science. Well, if so, why don't we have this as a topic and get people like Len Len Tan, who is one of the authors of the contributing chapter, Eiji Oguma from Japan, and Professor Gu Ping from Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. And we also felt that unless somebody comes from Japan, all these keynote speeches had been done in English language. The question is, why is this? It is understandable if you are at the discipline-based conference such as sociology and political science. Well, obviously, the conference requires the lingua franca, which, of course, in English. However, the area studies such as Japanese studies have option of presenting papers in the Japanese language, that is the language other than English, and surely keynote speakers can do that as well. But at this point, I floated an idea to the executive committee of the JSSA, and somebody mentioned that, that some of our postgrad students won't be able to comprehend this whole thing. For instance, if Professor Oguma or Professor Bu Pin give the whole talk in Japanese, not all postgrad would not be able to comprehend. So we had in this case, we had English translation of, English translation of the talk on the screen at the back of the speakers. And then, so the Professor Bu Pin, Professor Oguma made a keynote speech, but at the back, there was an English version running so that people are not excluded. How careful we have to be for the people who only have English language. To your question, how did the book come out? The book came out because we had to decide at the time when we were deciding on keynote speakers that we didn't like the idea that all keynote speakers came from what we call the center of knowledge production. Giving lectures and keynote speech in the dominant English language in the Japanese Studies Conference. And we thought for a change, we could do something different. And the JSSA is quite an tolerant or accommodating organization because it's quite a small association with a membership of about 300. academics of Australian universities, they were quite happy with it. So we went along. So that's the beginning of this book. Now, when we asked the keynote speakers, we requested this topic, how they see Japanese studies in light of the dominant tendency of Eurocentrism in knowledge production and the hierarchy of knowledge in the global scene. Professor Oguma already had thought about this in a great deal, so he was very happy to talk about it. And Oguma's chapter constitutes chapter two. He is a bit critical about the lack of or insufficient effort made by Japan-based Japanese scholars, that they have not made sufficient effort to engage in the global academic conversation. That is to say, they don't publish their research work in English. They publish everything in Japanese, and he quotes quite a large number of statistics to demonstrate this. He argues that it is because that Japan offers a sufficient market for the academic publication in the Japanese language. People don't have to publish in English. They have enough outlets of journals and books where they can share their findings and research with their colleagues in Japan. So there's no urgent need. So that was Oguma's chapter. And the following two chapters, since we wanted to become, we wanted to have this book as interdisciplinary as possible, I invited Lydia Tanaka, who is a social linguist, and Tomoko Aoyama, who is a literary scholar. These two chapters, Lydia Tanaka's chapter is very interesting in that she presents two different distinctive camps or schools of studying Japanese language. One is called Kogaku, the study of the national language, and the other one is called Nihongogaku, the study of the Japanese language. And she delineated the differences between the two in terms of historical development that is influenced by the political agenda of the government, as well as the modernization process. And she speculates where they are going in the future. Similar argument is presented by the following chapter, Tomoko Aoyama, in relation to kokubungaku, the Japanese literature, in a more traditional sense, and nihonbungaku, the Japanese literature. Again, Tomoko delineates the differences in terms of the process of development and the audience and the readership. But one of the striking findings, or one of the striking aspects that I was very interested in these two chapters, and this is the reason why we have approached these two to write these things, is that both Kokugogaku and Kokubungaku have maintained a relative autonomy of academic discipline, totally, largely, uninfluenced by, dominated by the global scholarship that comes out from North America and continental Europe, and Anglophone research traditions, theories, and so on. I find it quite interesting in a sense that these scholars did not feel the need to share their findings. But at the same time, I was quite impressed, I guess, in a positive sense, that they could hold out, they could resist this powerful flow of information, of knowledge, and the knowledge of Anglophone world. So that's quite an intro. These two chapters are quite interesting chapters in that sense. The following three chapters come from one, Lenden Tan is based in Singapore, and Duck and Lee is based on Canberra ANU. He talks about the Japanese studies in South Korea, which have a distinctive historical background in that Korea was under Japan's colonial rule for so many years during the pre-war period. And he describes how it affected the development of Japanese studies in post-war world. Then the former president of JSSA, Karen Stevens, wrote a chapter about Australia's view of Japan, how the Japanese studies was developed in Australia. And she does refer to the periphery nature of Australia. Then Australia, in a discussion of center-periphery in the knowledge production, it is often said that Australia is in semi-periphery, in that it is in an Anglophone world whereby academics can share their findings in English language journals, books, and so on and so on. But it is not at the center, because center core of the knowledge production and legitimation remains in North America and England. So that's the kind of second part. The first part was the Japanese studies and autonomy that these Japanese scholars maintain in Japan and the implications for that. And the second part was Japanese studies in the Asia-Pacific region, namely Southeast Asia, South Korea, and Australia. And the third part of the are written by Professor Bu Ping from Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. He hasn't published in English before, but he was the leader of the Chinese team in a collaborative project amongst three countries, namely PRC, South Korea, and Japan, to produce shared history textbook for high schools. I was very impressed and I was very intrigued by the whole project that emerged from civil society. It wasn't government directed. It emerged from academics and the secondary school teachers to come up with this project, and how the project progressed and challenges and difficulties that they faced naturally, and how they overcame these differences in a way that are productive to all parties concerned. Professor Bu Ping gave his own biography, starting with the Russian history scholar. I did a PhD in Russian history in Harbin Normal University. And then with the change of a PRC government policy, he mentioned that he was asked to learn Japanese language and to study Japanese history. And he became the historian of Japanese history. And it was quite interesting that his talk was really intriguing to all concerned, in a sense that we could see the Chinese perspective of the East Asian history in the way that we have not heard before. And the following chapter by Vera Maki is a professor of Japanese history and gender studies. She reported and examined another transnational history project in modern women, quote-unquote modern women, across East Asian societies, again, pointing out the difficulties and challenges. But more so, I thought that this paper, this particular chapter, gives us a kind of optimism in the way in which we can move forward in a collaborative project across East Asia. And then lastly, Yoshio Sugimoto proposes what he's called cosmopolitan methodology, which is a plural centric, in that no particular framework or paradigm, or which derives from a particular region, although there is a view that everything which comes from the West is universal, that's not the case. That he pursues the plural centric cosmopolitan methodology. So we thought something that started from quite a casual conversation in my office. As to who we should be inviting to this particular conference, about 2 years prior to the actual conference, which took place in July 2015, I was quite happy with the book, in a sense that the book had something to say about the current state of Japanese studies and area studies generally. In particular, when Yoshio argues that all science studies, all social science and humanities studies are area studies. If someone is studying about the minority issues in North America, it's actually an American's, something that the findings is come from a particular socio-cultural, geographical, materialist circumstances that is North America. But when we talk about area studies, it's often, we don't refer to the studies about Anglophone societies as an area studies.
Yes, I actually have some questions about that, and I'll get to my questions in a minute. I think the story of the book is absolutely fascinating. How it started from a conversation in your office, as you were saying, and then you had the conference, and it developed into a book. And just a short recap. So chapters 2, 3, and 4 discuss Japanese studies in the Japanese context. And then you have chapters 5, 6, and 7 talking about Japanese studies with a Southeast Asian perspective, and then in South Korea and Australia. And chapters 8 and 9 talking about transnational dialogues, transnational history, so transnational yes. project. And then...
Yes, transnational collaboration.
Yes.
Transnational collaboration in study
going
of history.
Beyond borders, right? And then chapter 10 is kind of the conclusion chapter, Professor Sugimoto's chapter, if I understand correctly. You failed to mention the first chapter, which, yes, your chapter, which is of course the introduction of the project, but you also make some very interesting points, thought-provoking remarks, and I would actually like to ask you a couple of questions about this first chapter, since it's yours, and I'm imagining you're comfortable talking about it. So you mention the original contributions to Japanese studies that the book can make. And you talk about 4 ways in which the book can contribute to Japanese studies. And the first one is focus on Japanese studies. The second one is multi-regional. The third one, multidisciplinary. And the fourth one, you talk about strategies. And I understand you also say that this whole book is the result of a process of actually interrogating Japanese studies from the periphery, and thus trying to shed some light on the manifestations of the Euro-American dominance, and so on and so forth. And if you could talk a bit more about those 4 ways in which you feel the book contributes to Japanese studies.
Okay, thank you very much. That we see the original contribution of this volume as fourfold, as you mentioned. One is that we focused on Japanese. You can write about Eurocentrism. We can write about rethinking Eurocentric, which actually many people has done so far. In other areas, political science, there is a critique of Eurocentrism in international relations, even Eurocentrism in the study of, in particular, India, where the post-colonial debate is very prevalent. But we don't often hear about Eurocentrism critique about the Japanese studies. For the reason that I'm not sure, actually, is this because the Japanese studies scholars don't feel that it is dominated by you? Is this because the Japanese national, Japan-born academics themselves are less aware of Eurocentrism or post-colonialist trend in the study of Japan? I am not sure, but I'm sure the people have a different idea. But the point is that we are doing this. We are rethinking about the Eurocentrism. We are critiquing the Japanese studies, current state of Japanese studies in terms of Eurocentrism. We think there is a Eurocentrism, Anglophone centrism, whereby the Japanese studies research is not acknowledged and given value or assessment unless it is published in English language. And the hierarchy of journals and the prestige of publication and so on is determined by the Japanese studies or social science in general at the center of this knowledge production. So the fact that we are focusing on Japanese studies is original. And we did this critique by looking at our region, since we are at the periphery. I think the fact that this came out of Japanese Studies Association of Australia has some, it really reflects the geographical specificity that Australia is semi-periphery. It is not at the center, although it has an advantage of being part of the English-speaking world. So we focus on China, South Korea, and many countries in Southeast Asia, and Australia, and Japan itself. And as Len and Tan's paper on Southeast Asia demonstrates, there is a diversity within the Southeast Asia, that the English-speaking world, Singapore, certainly has an advantage. The country-based conferences of Japanese studies uses either local language such as Thai language and the Japanese language, but when they formed the Japanese Studies Association -ASEAN, the medium of the lingua franca was English, but the fact that the association decided to have English as lingua franca for the conference meant that the people who were not educated in English-speaking world refused to attend. And a large number of the Len and Tan gives statistics as to the percentage of the university academics in Southeast Asia in terms of where they got the PhD, and many of them got PhD in Japan under the government, Japanese government scholarship. And these people published their work in Japanese in the Japanese journals rather than in English journals. So there is a kind of division within the Japanese studies community of ASEAN, Southeast Asian countries. And that's, I think, is quite an interesting point. I'm a social scientist. Yoshio is a social scientist. We wanted to make it multidisciplinary in a sense that we're not just talking about social science. We're talking about the literary study, which I have actually learned so much since I wasn't all that familiar with this, and also the linguistics. And lastly, we have presented some concrete strategies as to how we can possibly address the Eurocentrism in Japanese studies in the region. For example, we propose...
You actually talk about...
Yes. I actually talk about it and about think the concrete strategies of Eurocentrism. Some people say that this, some of them are a bit fanciful, in a sense that I mentioned that in order to address Eurocentrism, the people at the periphery had been asked to make effort, and that is publish in English journal, go to a conference and present the research in English and so on. Then I'm raising a question. It actually is the case that the people at the center is doing nothing. They can just listen to the findings, research, read the research in English, and the people at the periphery are asked to make extra effort to address this. So I'm suggesting that the people at the center could be more aware of this and include the work that are translated from non-English language as part of the reading list. Or the PhD thesis could have a kind of requirement that the thesis will need to include certain number of academic papers or books that have been translated from non-English language and so on. One could also say that doing a PhD, one has to learn one language other than English, but I might be going a bit too far there. So that's the kind of strategies that we have suggested, looking at the realities at the Australian universities, whereby the language other than English is not required even for a Bachelor of Arts degree, or it is not required even for people who are completing PhD in social sciences and humanities in general. So that's a very sad state.
Okay, very concrete strategies indeed. I would like to hear a lot more about this. And I actually have another question, which refers to the last chapter, Yoshio Sugimoto's chapter, where at the very end of the chapter, this is in a way, I imagine, a response to the first chapter that you wrote. And Yoshio Sugimoto talks about, he actually asks some questions, which I feel are very important. To give just a couple of examples, he asks, for example, what Japanese homegrown concepts and theories deserve international debate? How can we circumvent the institutional and structural impediments that stand in the way of the transnational circulation of Japanese social science scholarship? Or can we channel Japanese studies in Asia and beyond into the central arena? And personally, I feel that these are really essential, fundamental questions. And I wanted to ask you, maybe if you have the answer to these questions.
Well, I'm not sure if I can answer directly to these questions. But the Japanese studies, he asked, can Japanese studies in Australia develop a unique sensitivity to the scholarship in periphery? I think there is we are in a privilege. We academics based in Australia are more likely to be able to see that what it means to be at the periphery of academia than those who are at the periphery of the non-English speaking world. So in that sense, yes, I think to a certain extent that the Japanese studies in Australia hopefully can develop a unique sensitivity to the scholarship in the periphery. And hopefully that we can incorporate the research, very productive research that is done in the non-English speaking world into our own research, and then disseminate the findings of these research conducted at the periphery of non-English speaking world into our publications in English language, so that their findings can be known and be engaged in the more global academic discourse. the way in which the Japanese, one of the characteristics of Japanese studies in Australia is that we do not have a clear division between those who teach Japanese language and those who specialize in Japanese studies. I know that in North America and UK, in continental Europe, there isn't a separate association of Japanese language lecturers or teachers or instructors or educators at the tertiary level. Here, it's all together. And I think that's partly because all of us, whether the research interest is a study, history, sociology, or others, majority of us teach language as well. So that, I think, created perhaps a bit more inclusive environment of different kinds of research and teaching as the Japanese Studies Association of Australia. I felt quite strongly when I attend the conferences in North America and at the continent of Europe in that front. Hope I answered your question.
Yes, I was thinking about the fact that I'm actually familiar with the situation in Europe, and there, what I can tell you is that, for example, you have certain countries in Eastern Europe. I know the case of Romania or Bulgaria, even Hungary to a certain extent, where. In fact, you do have, for example, a Japanese Language Teachers Association, but you also have a couple of centers for research in Japanese studies. So on paper, things look like they're two different institutions, but in fact, the people involved in both are basically the same. So they're involved in Japanese language education as well as research in Japanese studies. One of the reasons could be, though, in countries like Romania or Bulgaria, the fact that there are very few researchers who are actually active researchers and teachers. Reading the book, I did find a lot of answers, but I also found a lot of questions, which is very important. And I think we have to keep thinking about these questions, even if we never find an answer to them. But I do agree that we do have to think about how we can channel, as Yoshio Sugimoto puts it, Japanese studies more into the central arena, beyond the English speaking, the Anglophone world, as you call it. And we could continue talking about the book, but I also wanted to ask you about other projects. If you have anything else on the horizon now, if there's anything that you're working on right now and that you would like to talk about.
Oh, thank you. I have project going on, one of which just produced the first edited volume quite recently, and we had the book launch last week at the Melbourne University. And this is a project called 30 Years of Talk, a longitudinal...
Oh, so it's a new book, which means we're going to have to do another interview.
I'm very happy to do so. I must say that this interdisciplinary project is very new to me. Being involved in this longitudinal project alone as my project. This is tracing a group of working class girls from since 1989 when I did a PhD at the working class schools in Kobe. I had 100 kids at the time, but after they graduated from high school and obtained full-time working class jobs, I have been following up a group of 22 girls or 21 girls until now. So I have all these ethnographic interview recording, and I've produced two books, monographs out of that. But then while I was doing this, I was struck by how the girls changed the way in which they speak to me in the interview, because these are the girls who are 18 when I first met in 1989. They're now about 46 years old. Some of them are already grandmother. So I invited Melbourne-based social linguists for them, if they are interested to analyze this ethnographic data, ethnographic interviews. And they were quite interested in this, since this kind of data is quite rare. So we, all of us, analyzed the data, and the book just came out. It's called Discourse, Gender, and Shifting Identities in Japan, the Longitudinal Study of Kobe Women's Ethnographic Interviews, 1989/2019, Phase 1. So we are hoping this will be the Phase 1 book, and we are hoping and planning to produce a Phase 2 or Phase 3 in the future.
What will Phase 2 be about, Phase 2, Phase 3?
Well, for the Phase 1, we concentrated on a particular girl, one particular girl, data, 1989 and 2000. In the Phase 2, we are looking at a larger number of girls, and say, for instance, focusing on employment and the language shift, employment and the shifting identities. We're thinking of focusing on one particular theme for the next book. But it's very time-consuming. As an anthropologist, I don't necessarily transcribe everything, but the linguists really transcribe in a very technical fashion everything. And one thing that I find it is a bit embarrassing, to tell the truth, is that not only do they analyze the language of the girls, the subject, they analyze my language as well. Because apparently the conversation, you know, you need to analyze all the participants of the conversation. So it was quite embarrassing and a bit intriguing to see how I speak in ethnographic interviews in search of the kind of information that I really want to get. So that's something that I find interesting. And certainly the language used over the years among these girls, but also I have changed the way in which I speak because of the changing nature of the relationship between myself and these girls. So that's the latest one, that this sociolinguistics, interdisciplinary sociolinguistics research. I'm also working on a monograph called Women in 30s in an anthropological sense, not the language analysis, but the analysis of their life trajectory in their 30s. The other one is that I'm writing a monograph on changes and challenges in the Japanese schooling. I had a book in 1991 by Cambridge University Press called Education in Contemporary Japan, Diversity and Social Inequality. And 20 years have passed since then. And quite a few people asked, you know, what's now? So I thought about updating the book, but I decided against it, leaving the book of 1999 as it is, and then produce the new book, focusing on the current changes and new development in light of what I wrote in 1999. So that's something that I'm working on.
Well, I actually look forward to hearing more about all those projects. And I'm actually looking forward to your new book. Perhaps we can also do an interview about your new book. Thank you very much. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us at New Books in East Asian Studies. For our listeners, this was Kaori Okano talking about the book she co-edited with Yoshio Sugimoto called Rethinking Japanese Studies, Eurocentrism and the Asia-Pacific Region. Thank you very much, Kaori.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Goodbye.
Bye.